It's Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is a doctor practicing geriatrics in North Carolina. In addition to his medical degree, Terrence Holt has a PhD in English literature and has written a new book of short stories called Internal Medicine. But first, sitting in for Gary Schweitzer to review the week's health news, is Scott Hensley of NPR's Health Desk. He's the co-host of the health blog Shots. Hi, Scott.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good. We haven't really talked much about Ebola on Medical Matters. You did some work with some poll data looking at how Americans view Ebola through the lens of this crisis. What did you find?
We were really interested in whether we could capture sentiment on something that's unfolding in such a rapid way. So I have to start out by saying that we asked 3,000 Americans in a poll conducted with Truven Health about Ebola, a dozen questions, and these questions were fielded during the first half of October when things in Dallas were still unfolding, and I need to put a caveat on that so they don't reflect some of the most recent things. Nevertheless, I think we did find some kind of interesting information, and you know, one thing which I don't think is a shocker, but that we should stipulate because it was important for the polling, was were people aware of the Ebola outbreak in Africa and the things that were happening here? And the media has done a great job of awareness. Let's be clear about that. 97% of people knew about the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And once we had that as a baseline, we asked, well, is the U.S. doing a good enough job in responding? And we were thinking about that mainly with West Africa. And a slim majority, about 53%, said that they thought the U.S. had done, you know, an okay job, at least an okay job. And I think even before most recent events, we found that people are worried. They're concerned about this. People were either, if you put together the people who said they were very concerned or somewhat concerned, that's a majority. 56% of people said that they were concerned that Ebola could become a real health problem here in the U.S.
Now, this is pre-New York, so this is just when we've heard about the Thomas Eric Duncan case in Dallas. And did we know then that the two young nurses had already tested positive for Ebola?
I would have to go back and look at the chronology, but at least one of them had tested positive toward the end of our questioning period. So that would have been in the consciousness of some people, but you know, I'd have to say that that might not have been there for most people. One of the things that came up in the poll, which was interesting, was that three-quarters of the people, and this is one of the stronger responses, you know, were in support of travel bans to and from Africa to try and limit the spread of the disease. And, you know, now we have the New York case of the doctor who went over to help and then came back and tested positive for Ebola and some of the quarantine issues happening in New Jersey and New York. I think part of the problem here is I can understand this natural feeling of let's close off the borders to minimize our risk. But I think everything that we've heard and everything that we've seen suggests that until the outbreak is quelled in West Africa, really no part of the globe is safe. So the idea of preventing travel in and out of the area is not realistic, and it won't help solve the root problem. We need to find better ways to protect people who are going over there to help. But I think the idea that we would be able to minimize the risk to Americans by preventing travel is a kind of false hope.
Thanks for that. You also highlighted a wonderful investigative collaboration between the newspaper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and MedPage Today, looking at something called surrogate markers. Tell us what is meant by that.
Yeah. I'll concede this is a nerdy subject area, but I think this collaboration, which is a multi-part series, and we've only seen, as of today, the first parts of the series, I think it does a lot to illuminate why people should pay attention to this and care. And one of the things that I think your audience may be aware of is that there has been some real progress in cancer drugs. If you look at the drugs approved by the Food and Drug Administration, many of the really new drugs have been in the cancer area, and they are very expensive. Some of these drugs cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. The issue is, on what basis has the Food and Drug Administration made a decision that these drugs are okay to bring to the market? And this is where the surrogate measure comes in. And so in the past, it was more common for a study to say, well, did more patients live or die if they got this experimental drug versus either the standard therapy or a placebo?
Those are endpoints that matter.
Yes, those are the clinical things that, you know, hey, doc, am I going to live? Is this drug going to help me? And what's happened is, and I think this is a nuanced issue, because when something is life and death, you might want to try and speed up the evaluation and approval process of the drug. One way to do that would be, you know, since some of these illnesses take a while to resolve one way or the other, is to look at something that would give you a hint of what the future may hold. So in cancer, that might be, does the tumor get bigger, or does it stay the same size, or maybe does it get smaller? And you would think intuitively, oh, well, if the tumor gets smaller or stays the same size, then the patient probably has a chance of living longer than the patients whose tumors grow. But it turns out it's not as easy as all that. And the issue that's illuminated in this series is that these surrogate measures, these in-between things that people can look at either on an X-ray image or maybe there's a blood test where they can look for the presence of a particular marker in the bloodstream, may be helpful in the early stages of drug development, but by themselves, over the fullness of time, they may actually be misleading. And so the question is, can we trust some of these drug approvals? And a subsidiary question, which I think is really important, is most of the time, the companies are allowed to go ahead with approvals using this shortcut if they promise to do the studies of the old-fashioned kind. Did patients live longer when they got this drug versus not? And all too often, the companies don't fulfill that commitment. Sometimes the FDA says, well, we don't think you need to do it. Other times, it's that the companies just don't do it. So the issue here is, what's the level of proof that the FDA should require to approve a new drug? And when does a shortcut that looks like a way to bring a promising new therapy to patients faster turn out to have this downside of being a sort of a phantom signal, or one that's not borne out by the fuller gold standard studies?
Just another example of how when we finally think we understand something, we just realize how slippery the science is behind it and how little we actually know.
I think that's a point.
And, you know, these cancer drugs are not inexpensive. I mean, some of them cost on the order of $10,000 a month. So there's a lot at stake in terms of getting these things fast-tracked and approved.
Yes, and the second story in this series points out that even if the benefits aren't always clear, that there are real side effects, and some of them are quite profound. So, you know, you could be fooled, in a sense, into thinking that a drug is better than it is on the effectiveness side, or, you know, in hoping for that benefit, take on a risk of side effects that maybe you would choose not to take if you really knew what the full risk and benefit was.
Scott Hensley is the co-host of NPR's health blog, Shots. Scott, great to talk to you. Thanks for pinch hitting this week.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
Scott Hensley is co-host of NPR's health blog, Shots. I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. We're lucky to have a rich trove of medical professionals who are also gifted writers, from William Carlos Williams to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, from Anton Chekhov to Abraham Verghese. Our guest today, Terrence Holt, represents an inverted journey. He started his career as a professor of literature, only to change course and start medical school past the age of 40. Now a practicing geriatrician, he has returned to his first love, literature. His new book of short stories is named for the field in which he and I both practice, internal medicine. Terrence Holt, welcome to Medical Matters. Congratulations on your new book. There, I counted 9 short stories in all. And I guess my first question is, why did you choose fiction to tell these stories? Because you talk in the prologue really about this being about your experiences as a resident. Why choose fiction?
When I was writing the things, I wasn't thinking much about form. I started doing it shortly after finishing my residency. At the time, I thought I'd given up writing. When I went to medical school, I thought I was in the past and I was going to just devote myself to medicine. But practically, the minute my residency was over, I started writing again. Initially, just for myself, I sense of what had happened over the last several years. And I started, they started getting published, a few of them in various places. And at the time, I published them as fiction because I didn't want anybody to be confusing the people in there with actual patients. The patients in there are composites. The hospital is a composite. There's no direct one-to-one relationship between those individuals and actual people. I felt strongly that I needed to protect my patients that way. But at the same time, I felt just as strongly that I wanted to write a book that people would understand as an honest, accurate reflection of what goes on during residency. So what they are is they're a blend. They're nonfiction and fiction both. I wrote an author's introduction, which is something I never expected to be doing, to try to explain the method. I don't want anybody to be confused about what's true and what isn't. So it's a hybrid form, really. I think the book itself says nonfiction on it, but the fact of the matter is it doesn't fit into either category entirely.
It's labeled as a memoir, which it very much feels like when you read it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm wondering what difference from a writer's standpoint there is about using fiction. Are you able to then fit facts that fit your narrative, or is the tone different, or I guess the voice, the narrator's voice?
Well, I was a fiction writer long before I went into medicine, so it's a form that just comes naturally to me. To tell the truth, the distinction between fiction and nonfiction is, it's hard to figure out where the line goes. I mean, if you think about it, anybody who's taken a creative writing workshop, practically the first thing they hear is that you write based on your own experience, and nonfiction, if you think about it, can never really live up entirely to its claims to be the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. All historical accounts are partial. So I'm not deeply concerned about the distinction, but the really hard thing about these stories was, even while I was having to include, let's call fictional elements in there, that is, these composite characters that are the patients and the composite institution that's the hospital, and the narrator himself, because he's in a slightly different setting, dealing with slightly different people, isn't quite exactly me. I didn't want to introduce any events simply to hype it up. I think one of the problems that it's hard to avoid when writing about medicine is to see it as a form of drama. You know, certainly it lends itself to that. But I wanted this to be something that the people I trained with, for instance, could read and say, oh, yeah, that's what it was like. So it was some of the hardest writing I've ever done, trying to abide by those rules. And looking back at it, I think I managed it, but I shed a fair amount of blood and sweat over it along the way.
Well, I think you succeeded because, I mean, I read it with a medical eye, and it is very, as you say, it's not trumped up, or it's not, you let the drama, in a sense, speak for itself. It doesn't need to be gilded in any way. And it's really something. I mean, I strongly identify with the narrator of the book. And it's interesting to note that you say that you answered one of my questions, which was, you know, how much of the narrator is actually you. So the narrator, too, in the stories is somewhat of an amalgam. I mean, partially you, but partially fictionalized.
Yeah, there was one change, for instance, I felt I had to make. I was a great deal older than the typical resident. Medicine is my second career. And I didn't want that fact, which was pretty important to me while I was going through it, mainly because I was just so tired all the time. You know, I had kids, and my life was complicated in ways that most of my peers weren't. I didn't want that to be the focus of the book, because then it would seem idiosyncratic. I wanted this to be understood as representative. So I toned that down a lot. It's still there, but it's certainly not a central focus. So he's younger, and I have him make mistakes that I didn't make. I think he does better at some things than I did too. So he's, you know, he's me in a different continuum somewhere.
He seems, at least in one story, like he's pretty good at teamwork and running codes. And by codes, for our listeners, I mean, you know, trying to resuscitate patients who are in extremis, who may be dying. And you know, I think you give an interesting literary twist, which is a truism, I think, for us in the medical profession, which is that even when you run a very synchronized code and you resuscitate someone, often the results may be not what we want. And I guess without a spoiler, can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, that was one of the earlier stories I did. The word code, it attracted me because there is a lot of code in medicine. Some of it's pretty transparent, and some of it is made deliberately opaque. And that seemed to me to be just one step away from the utter mysteriousness of medicine itself. I mean, we deal with the great mysteries, and often, very often, we're in a situation where we don't have the full picture of what's going on. We very often can't get access to facts we very much wish we could have in order to make a diagnosis and find the right treatment for somebody. And it was letting those ideas percolate for a while, finally turned into that story. It, to some extent, that story is a reflection on what it might mean to write about medicine. It seems to me it's a little risky, ethically, to be taking events like that and turning them into stories, into art. And to some extent, the story, for me at least, the story is a meditation on that, on the difference between art and medicine. Art strives for perfection. And medicine, we may try to do the impossible in trying to keep, wouldn't it be great if all our patients could live and be healthy forever? But, you know, we fall so far short of perfection. And we have to recognize that. Otherwise, we risk doing people harm. You need to be well aware of our mortal condition and what that means, I think, if you're going to practice a humane and respectful medicine.
The name of that story is The Perfect Code, and that's one of nine stories in the volume. We're speaking with Terrence Holt, who's the author of the new volume called Internal Medicine from LiveRight, just out from LiveRight. You talked a little bit about your medicine being your second career. So we can't get too far into this interview without asking you why. First, tell us, you know, your first career is also unusual in the sense of where I went to medical school, Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, they prided themselves on what they called bent arrows. That were people who were coming into medical school for a second career. But I would say that very few, if any, were English professors. So you were previously an English professor at Rutgers and then
That's right.
a fellow at Swarthmore. So tell us, I guess, tell us about your journey.
I grew up in a medical household. My father was a doctor. My mother was an RN. I have an older brother who's an orthopedic surgeon. But being the third son, I was clearly obligated to go off in another direction. And I was interested in writing very, very early on. And so I pursued that. I got an MFA degree in creative writing at Cornell and then went on and got a doctorate in English literature. It seemed to me if you're going to write well, you should probably understand what you were doing as well as possible. And from that, I went on and had a teaching job at Rutgers, which was a great place to teach. I also had a fellowship at the Fine Arts Work Center of Provincetown in there for a couple of years and then was writer in residence at Swarthmore. But, you know, when you turn 40, people, you know, start to get sick, if that is, if you're lucky enough not to encounter a serious illness yourself. And this happened to some people that I'm very close to, and I found myself spending a lot of time in doctors' waiting rooms, holding people's hands. And I met a lot of doctors that way. And I met some who really impressed me with what they were doing, because I realized what they were doing was very much what I was doing. They were interpreting stories that people were bringing them. That's not my insight. That belongs to a physician at Columbia named Rita Sharon. But, you know, they were doing that interpretation. And then the difference between what I was doing as a literary critic and writer and what they were doing was they could actually change the story. They could take action that had an effect in the real world. And I found that enormously attractive. And so I took some night classes at the University of Pennsylvania, the pre-med stuff that I never took when I was an undergraduate the first time, and resigned my teaching job and went to medical school.
What did your departmental colleagues say at that time?
You know, that's a good question. I don't really recall. It's something of a while ago. Good luck, and I think they were looking at me a little askance, but I was so happy to be doing it. I was so excited about it that whatever they said clearly didn't leave much of an impression.
And then you went to medical school, or you got into medical school, and then how did you decide on a practice in geriatrics?
Yeah, that's actually a good story because it gives me a chance to thank somebody who's been very important to me. I went into medical school saying that because I was old by medical school standards, that I really wasn't going to do any kind of specialty. I just wanted to get out and practice right away. Also, I really wanted from the get-go to be an internist. I liked the idea of general about halfway through my residency, I was in the hospital, and I heard one of the senior clinicians speaking on the phone. She identified herself by name. I'd never met her, but I said to myself, I've admitted so many of her patients over the last couple of years, I probably ought to introduce myself. And I did. She was the chief of geriatrics, and after about 5 minutes to talk with her, I realized I wanted to be a geriatrician. So I did, and I've been very happy with that decision and very grateful to Dr. Busby Whitehead, is her name, ever since. It's an absolutely fascinating area of medicine for a lot of reasons, mainly the patients who are just endlessly interesting people.
And do you think that it has, in a sense, to do, you mentioned being an older medical student, do you think it has to do with your literary sense that the elderly have accrued the most stories, or?
Well, that is what you hear about older patients, and I think it is true. They have more to say for themselves, having seen more. One of the frustrations of clinical medicine, though, is even though we do generally spend longer with our patients in geriatrics because they're so much more complicated than younger people, you never do get a chance to hear the stories as much as you'd like. But I do greatly enjoy hearing what I do get to hear. And medically, they are very, very complicated, and you can make a huge difference in somebody's quality of life by just changing just little things around the margins, like adjusting medications and addressing problems that don't get addressed so centrally in other practices, like arthritis or, you know, other problems that might seem small but loom very large when, you know, when you're older and those things start to pile up on you.
Your previous book was another collection of short stories. You seem to clearly relish the form of the short story. Have you thought about novels or perhaps even writing plays?
Plays, no. I love plays. I go to the theater whenever I can, but I regard plays as something of a miracle. I have the same response to novels. I like to read them, but I'm happiest with a very contained form. Also, given my life, it would be hard to imagine maintaining the kind of continuity that a novel requires. I like the short story form because you can't waste a word. Everything in there has to be doing more than one thing. And the process of paring the story down to its essentials so that it stays within the length of a short story, it helps me to understand what I'm writing. It seems to be the form in which I'm happiest.
Where do you get your ideas from?
I don't ever sit down with what most people think of as an idea for a story. For me, a story isn't a vehicle for an idea. A story is how I discover things. I sit down to write without any preconceived notion of where the story is going to go. It may start with a memory of a specific event, wondering what happened to that person afterwards, that kind of thing. Sometimes it's simply an image or a voice or a word that comes. For some reason, it grabs my attention, and I can't seem to get it out of my mind. And eventually, I sit down and use that as a starting point to see where it goes. But the story constructs itself that my job is to let it have its head, try not to jump to any conclusions about it. And that way, it's a little bit like medical diagnosis, where you really have to suspend judgment and gather information. And at the end, what I've got is a story that I then have to go back and figure out what's going on in it. And that's where the revision begins. I revise a lot, and it's in that process that I finally get a coherent notion of what the story means for me, and that guides me through the process of revision.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Terrence Holt, who is the author of a recently published collection of short stories called Internal Medicine, just out from Live Right Press. And we're talking about the fact that you're a physician, a geriatrician, and also a writer. In your story, actually it's the first story in the volume, it's called A Sign of Weakness, you really write, it's the beginning of your internship, and you're taught what we would call an adage from the hidden curriculum. That is, as an intern, you don't want to appear weak, which means asking for help. And I was wondering if you would read the passage on page 27.
Yeah, this is the end of a very long night, the very first night on call for this intern, which he enters quite nervously, quite appropriately nervously. And just as, you know, late in the afternoon, he runs into a much older and wiser doctor who tells him a little joke, a standard joke, about his first night on call when the resident said to him, "If you need me, I'll be right behind that door." But remember, it's a sign of weakness. And unfortunately, this narrator takes that far too much to heart, and he tries all night to do something that he didn't understand from the start was doomed. This was a patient who was dying, and there was nothing that he could do that was going to change that. But he tries anyway. And it's 6 a.m. in the morning, and he's entered the patient's room after having been called there by the nurse. Fast asleep, even comatose, a living body moves. The chest expands, the nostrils flare, the eyelids twitch. Pulses stir the skin, and over all of these there hovers an inarticulate hum of life. But a dead body is only that. Dead. A body, given over to gravity and decay. The muscle tone that lends expression to the face is gone. The face is slack, the skin gone gray-green with the absence of blood. Underneath, if you turn it over, you will find it pooled to the backside, a livid bruise. I went through the motions of declaring death. Her eyes took my flashlight passively, the beam falling into the cloudy darkness of her pupils without a sign. I laid a stethoscope on her chest, only sporadic pings and creaks, sounds of a building settling in the night. Her flesh was cold, malleable, inert. There were papers to fill out, organ donation, autopsy permission, the death certificate. I puzzled over cause of death, wondering just what process I had failed to reverse. Respiratory failure, I finally wrote. Secondary to pulmonary fibrosis. Secondary to systemic sclerosis. The last line asked if any underlying medical conditions, diabetes, hypertension, for example, had contributed to the patient's demise. I looked at that a long time and finally left it blank. By the time I was done, the hospital had come to life around me. The intern who had signed out Mrs. B to me scratched the name off her patient list. Keith, the resident, appeared on the floor just before rounds got underway. "How was your night?" I told him. He listened to the story, pulled his lower lip, shook his head. "You should have called me." I flinched. "What would you have done?" "Nothing," he said. "Just like you. There was nothing to do. But at least we could have done it together."
That's Terrence Holt reading from his short story called A Sign of Weakness, which is in the volume called Internal Medicine. It's a beautiful passage, and there's so much in it. It's so rich. But a couple of things really strike me. First was the sort of overwhelming emotional feeling that comes through the writing as a brand new intern dealing with his first death, really, his first death as a real, you know, a quote-unquote real doctor, and the sort of absolute helplessness you feel. And then secondly is this sort of the mechanisms of death, having to fill out this paperwork for which you basically have no training and no guidance.
That's right. In our hospital, it's called the death packet. And the first time you confront it, it's baffling. Fortunately, there are nurses who are willing to guide you through that in the same way nurses guided me through the first several months of my internship. Yeah, it is. It's a terrible irony that we generate so much paper after we die.
And I was also, you know, really touched by, at least in the story, I don't know how much there was reality in it, but how your resident, you chose, or the narrator, I should say, because this is a work of memoir or fiction, chose, you know, to try to be tough and try to not call for help. But how honest and genuine the resident, who's the senior in this pair, who's gone through these experiences, says, you know, I could have been there too. And you say, or the narrator says, you know, what would you have done? Well, nothing. I just would have been here with you. And that sweetness of the sort of commiseration. And I think when you're writing a memoir of residency, I mean, in some ways, that's what it's all about. It's that very lonely feeling of becoming a professional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it occurs to me just now. I just spent the last week in the hospital working with the inpatient geriatrics team, and there was one of our patients was dying, and he had no family. And we all found this very distressing, and the nurse practitioner on the team suggested we try to find a volunteer who could at least be in the room with the patient and hold the patient's hand. Sometimes that's the most important thing you can do, is just be there. And I think to some extent what the resident says there is echoing that. It's a really important fact about the fundamentally human nature that we share with our patients. And sometimes that's all we have to give, but it's the most important thing we have to give.
Who are your literary influences?
A lot of the people that I feel shaped my style when I was younger are 19th century short story writers like Hawthorne. There's a story later in this volume which is a nod to Hawthorne, a Hawthorne story. Edgar Allan Poe has always been important to me. You don't hear much of him in this book because the style here is as pared down as possible. William Carlos Williams, in as far as 20th century writers go, has been very inspirational to me. He was a general practitioner in New Jersey in the 20s and 30s who wrote, well, brilliant poetry that he's mainly known for, but equally brilliant short stories about medicine and other things. And he was the supreme minimalist, both as a poet and as a writer of narratives, and that's been very helpful to me. More recently, Peter Matheson, the novelist who died within the past year, I had enormous respect for because of his... You know, he was able to write about the biggest topics of all, problems of mortality and human suffering, and yet do that in a way that wasn't remotely pretentious or heavy-handed, always exciting. I mean, he wrote page-turners about the most important human issues of all, and I just found his example really encouraging to me.
Is there a particular Peter Matheson work you'd recommend for a new
book? Yeah, it's one of his earlier novels. It's called Far Tortuga, as in the Tortuga Islands down in the Gulf of Mexico. It's ostensibly a story about the crew of a small fishing boat working its way west across the Gulf against a stiff headwind, but it's about much more than that. I will never forget, one of the, in the edition I have, which I think is the first edition, it was set so that from time to time you turn a page and are facing a blank page, and I won't ruin it by telling anybody what those blank pages mean, but I remember when I realized what that was, I burst into tears. The only writer who's ever made me weep over a blank page.
You are also, I mean, carrying on your academic tradition from your English literature days, you are also in academic medicine. You practice at the University of North Carolina. Do I understand correctly that you have put in the work to develop an interdisciplinary master's degree program, a master's in arts program?
That's right. That's I and some other people in both the School of Medicine and my academic department, the Department of Social Medicine, and chiefly in English, but other departments in the College of Arts and Sciences. It's on the books now, and I'm responsible for getting it off the ground. We're going to start admitting our first class of students this fall. It's very exciting. You know, having a foot firmly in both parts of campus, and we're very fortunate at UNC that we've got a one of the best medical schools in the country, literally across the street from one of the best universities in the country, with just a lot of people who were already interested in thinking about medicine and health from a variety of perspectives. We've got this resource, and I can't wait to see what happens when we can get people from medicine and humanities in the same room working together. I think that kind of interchange, which is hard to do because we're all so busy, I think that's going to be very important for both worlds. I think the medical world is starting to recognize that there are limits to what strictly numerical knowledge can tell us. Medicine is ultimately an art, and because medicine is ultimately about people, and we have no algorithms, we have no science that fully understands people and all their amazing variety. That's what the humanities are for. And this program that we've got here is part of a resurgence of interest in the humanities in the world of medicine, and an interest in medicine in among humanities scholars and students.
Well, along those lines, you, in furtherance of your academic mission, I believe are engaged in some research around the impact of narrative with patients. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is something that had its origin ways back. I designed a standard clinical trial to test one of the hypotheses of the narrative medicine movement, which is that narrative is good for you, that writing can help you to integrate troubling experiences, things like that. But, studies like that require some funding. Well, in the past year, working with people in our Institute for Arts and Humanities and a consortium of a number of different universities really around the world, we got funding originally from the Mellon Foundation, for which I'm very grateful, that has been transmitted through a number of mechanisms that is going to allow us to do a three-year study of this hypothesis. We're going to be getting groups of retirees in the retirement communities where I practice medicine together to
A StoryCorps type project with the written word, perhaps, right, as opposed to the spoken word. So one question about that is, will you exclude people with a diagnosis of dementia, or will you include them and see if they're able to either orally or, you know, in some way put pen to paper?
That's a great question. It, not surprisingly, it has come up. For the purposes of a trial, especially early on, to keep things simple, dementia is an exclusion criteria. But later, as this evolves, I'm very interested in seeing what we might be able to do with people who are suffering some form or degree of cognitive loss. Because, you know, I'm sure you know, one of the clinical truisms about most forms of dementia is that you can recall events from your early life quite well, even though you may not know what you had for breakfast. I'm also curious to know if, even in a case where somebody has lost a significant amount of short-term memory, if the process of writing down narratives might change cognitive function somehow. You know, we don't know much at all about what happens in dementia. We don't, you know, it's just part of that huge mystery of the mind. And narrative is also a little mysterious. What I do know about narrative is that it's the oldest product of the human race still largely in use. I mean, most of us don't have fires in our homes and go around carrying stone axes, but the stories that we tell each other and listen to from our very earliest years, in which, you know, when we grow up, are part of a huge industry. That's a striking fact, and it suggests to me that there's something about narrative, about the stories and storytelling and listening to stories, that must be deeply wired into our brains. And I would be very interested to know if that is something that survives and could allow us to help people as they're losing other faculties to Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. But that's down the road.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is author and physician Terrence Holt. The name of the volume, Internal Medicine, a collection of short stories. Why did you choose the name Internal Medicine? It's relatively straightforward, but perhaps lacking in artifice.
Well, yeah, the lacking in artifice part is, I think, part of the method of the book. There's a story told about the British author, Thackeray. He'd been working on his magnum opus for some time before he realized that he was going to call it Vanity Fair. And he was so happy when he realized that was the title of the book that he got up and danced around the room. And I felt pretty much that way when I realized I could use Internal Medicine as the title for the book, partly because I'm very happy that I'm an internist. I think it's a wonderful specialty, but also because it addressed what I think is the most salient feature of those stories, which is that they may seem to be about patients and sickness and all that, but what they're really about, where the drama lies, is within that character who's telling those stories. It's about the internal development of that person as he faces all of these trials and evolves into a certain kind of a doctor. It also brought in the part of the book in which it's very often the patients who, to some extent, heal that doctor of his own difficulties with his involvement in what they're going through, which is something that I see often enough that's part of my awe of the people I treat, is how very often somebody in extremis will turn to the people around him and make a gesture that shows he or she is still caring for them and trying to take care of them. So it's internal and it's medical and it's very much about the spirit.
Terrence Holt, I wonder if I could get you to read one more passage. Page 118, there in the middle. The name of the story is When I Was Wrong.
This story takes place largely in the intensive care unit, where the narrator is the resident in charge of a team of house staff and medical students, kind of the sergeant to the attending physician. And it involves a patient who is admitted having had a disastrous stroke, the kind of thing that where the neurosurgeons say there's nothing to be done, and the question is that the narrator is has to address to the patient's family as well, would she want us to keep her alive in this condition, which is a question that we have to ask people very often. But he starts to worry pretty early on because a events start to take on a momentum of their own, and he's very, very worried as what his motives might be. What does he actually want out of this situation? And he starts to worry that his wishes, desires, and fears in the case could be steering him wrong. But after rotating through the unit several times, I came to understand what my peers were saying when they said they enjoy the ICU, even though I knew I would never share the feeling. There is a simplicity about unit work, a freedom from the messy problems of discharge and placement, even from many of the refinements of therapy. The things we do to people there are, for the most part, brutal, simple, and effective. We sustain breath with an adjustable air pump. We support blood pressure with any combination of four different drugs. We fight off infection by the simple means of hosing down the patient with the three or four antibiotics necessary to cover the entire spectrum of known pathogens. The patient doesn't talk back. The patient doesn't move. The nurses are generally brilliant. As medicine, it's relatively simple. And there is a pure and uncomplicated pleasure in taking a patient who is minutes away from death and dragging him out of darkness into light. The problem, of course, is that sometimes you fall short of that goal. Too often, we're able to rescue somebody from death but can't quite bring him back to life. People get stuck in that horrible twilight in between. And while they may not be able to tell you, it's difficult to escape the impression that, even if they could, they wouldn't want to thank you. This is something it can be difficult for people to understand, especially when the patient is someone who just that morning or the week before had been a fully living, fully functional, and deeply loved human being. We practice a scrupulous ethics in my hospital. Patients decide the limits of their care. If they can't talk, the family tells us what to do. And no matter what I think of their decision, I am bound to respect their wishes up to the point where my efforts are clearly futile, and then the question is moot. At that point, usually, the patient speaks in the only way left to him, by dying despite everything I can do. Whenever the decision is taken out of my hands, I feel relieved. Who would want the power to decide?
And that's Terrence Holt reading from his short story, When I Was Wrong, that's found in his new book, Internal Medicine. And I have never read three paragraphs that graphic and succinct that beautifully encapsulate what it is to work, or for that matter, to be a patient or see a family member in an intensive care unit. I mean, simplistically brutal, as you use that word, or both of those words, simple, brutal, and effective. And the metaphor of hosing down patients with antibiotics was, I mean, I laughed out loud because we just so often do that. But I mean, and then to finish it off with the passage about ethics and then the power to decide, I mean, that is really a fraught, beautifully written.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. I mean, that question that ends that passage is one that I think haunts all of us. We come very close often to being in a position where we're at least offered the power to decide. And I don't really think I am that wise or that good to be able to make decisions like that about other human beings. And yet sometimes you're in a position where it does fall to you in a variety of ways. Families will often ask you what to do. And even though we teach the medical students that you have to respect the patient, or in this case, the surrogate decision makers of the patient, you have to respect that person's decision-making capacity, the autonomy of the patient is sacrosanct. I worry that sometimes we abandon people by saying, well, it's your decision. I mean, sometimes we're asked for guidance, and because we've spent so much time there, we know that situation so well, I think we're obligated to try to offer guidance. But at the same time, precisely because we do spend so much time in these really dire situations, you have to wonder if your perspective is really the one that family or that patient needs. It's a terrible conundrum, because ultimately it's an unanswerable question. Should this person live or die? I can't ever imagine feeling that I would know how to answer that question. You know, even if I did, I would hate to have to. And yet, the thing about medicine is that often you're put in a position where you have to act in a situation where you don't really know enough to be confident in what you're doing. That's where the stress in medicine comes from, at least as I understand it.
Yeah, getting more comfortable with the uncertainty, certainly. Terrence Holt, I want to thank you so much for appearing on the program. It was a pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you great success with the book. The name of the book is Internal Medicine. It's subtitled A Doctor's Stories. There are 9 short stories in the volume. It's by author Terrence Holt. It's his second book, and it's just out from LiveRight.
Thank you.
Terrence Holt is a doctor and the author of the new book, Internal Medicine. I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. For comments or questions about the show, email me directly at schumann.john@gmail.com. That's schumann.john@gmail.com. We've been focusing today on storytelling in medicine. Our previous guest, Terrence Holt, had plenty to say on the matter, but our commentator, Alice Drager, has a few other points to make about the provenance of our stories as patients. Who really owns our medical stories?
I get why some doctors want other doctors to learn how to write stories about their patients. The idea is to help physicians learn to think about patients as whole people, rather than as mere compilations of lab results. In writing a narrative about a patient, the physician reflects on the patient's backstory, the patient's worldview, and even the patient's character. But it worries me. By way of background, I'm not a doctor, although I sleep with one. I'm a professional writer and historian of medicine, and I teach at a medical school. I also work as an advocate for people who have accidentally become victims of medical trauma. These are people who went into a hospital hoping to be helped and accidentally getting hurt badly. Sometimes, as part of my advocacy, I write these people's stories. In some circumstances, with the victim's permission, I write their stories for public consumption, in order to get other people to understand problems in medicine and to try to fix them. But in other circumstances, when victims and I have agreed that they might benefit from me writing down their history privately, just for them, I do that pro bono. In such cases, the history looks very different from what I write for the public. For the public, the story is, well, it's compelling, it's persuasive, because it has an agenda that is at some level mine. For the private, client-centered histories, the agenda is theirs. In those cases, I'm trying to help answer the questions they have about what happened to them, why it happened, how it happened. When I decide to do a client-centered history for a victim of medical trauma, I tell the clients that what I write is theirs to do with what they want, and that I will never write or speak publicly about their story, even if they ask me to. That's because I have to make sure I completely turn off any chance of my own agenda awakening. That's because I know that when I've met someone whose story I want to use for public writing, my brain starts to do a thing where it turns them into a narrative arc with a clear moral to their story. Doctors who write about their patients are almost always really doing it for themselves, to make themselves more engaged and more caring, and those are noble goals. But they're not really about the patient's agenda first and foremost. Moreover, the doctor almost always writes him or herself into the story, becoming another character to be judged. Self-reflection is a fine thing, but it does open the door to self-absorption. Perhaps if doctors writing stories about their patients committed to always showing the stories to those patients, the focus on the patient's own story would remain. But I think many patients might reasonably wonder whether they want a doctor whose muse is perhaps more present than his or her nurse.
Alice Drager is a professor of clinical medical humanities at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. She lives in East Lansing, Michigan. That's our show for today. Medical Matters is produced at Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. You can contact the program by emailing me at schumann.john@gmail.com. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Music for the show is created by Scott Griffith. Our theme music is by Europa 51. You've been listening to Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. This concludes our second series of Medical Matters programs. We hope to be back in the spring. I'm John Schumann.